storm that blew up, and this shows the power of this storm. The waves were so high that they were breaking over that seawall and going a block or two into the streets of the city of Tiberias and actually blowing out storefront windows in there. So we're talking waves that were 20 feet high or higher, with enough force to travel a block or two inland and break out store windows. And this is the power of storms that can come on the Sea of Galilee, even though the Sea of Galilee is very small, only about 8 by 10, 11 miles, something like that. And what happens is it's down in a valley, and the winds can come in out of the deserts, and they blow down into this bowl, and it can really stir up the waters and create a severe storm in a very short time. So this is what is being described here and documented here. So Jesus arises and he stills the storm there. And this is probably another remez here. And you might write down in your notes Psalm 107, 24 and 25. Psalm 107, 24 and 25, which says, "They see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. For he commands and raises the stormy wind, which lifts up the waves of the sea." But regardless, this does show that Jesus has the power over nature, the wind and the waves, the physical elements, the weather. So again, that's Psalm 107, 24 and 25. Okay, verse 40, "But he said to them, 'Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?' And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, 'Who can this be, that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" So now, continuing on with the story, Mark 5, we come to a quite remarkable story of what happens when they reach the other side, the pagan side of the Sea of Galilee. Verse 1 of Mark 5, "Then they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gadarenes. And when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit." So a couple of things to mention here. One is that Matthew actually says there were two men. And presumably that's true because Matthew was there. He's one of the 12. And we occasionally see things. Again, this is the type of thing Bible critics will jump on and say, well, you can't believe this because Mark says there is one man and Matthew says there's two. They obviously disagree. Well, no. They just include the details that are important to them. Mark is focusing on the one man because he's the more prominent. He's the one Jesus is interacting with. And Matthew says there are two, and the other is just obviously there in the background. Matthew remembers that. He's one of the 12 who is there with Jesus. So it simply means that one of the men is much more prominent, and he's the one who stands out. So that's where the emphasis of Mark and Luke is. So all of their emphasis is on telling the story of what happened there, not getting all of the details precisely in alignment. The story of what happens is the same in all three. It's just that Matthew includes the additional detail. There are two people there, not just the one who is most prominent. Now it mentions they met him out of the tombs. What's that talking about? Well, many tombs of that period were like a shallow cave. Actually, many of them were natural caves because it's all limestone cliffs around that area, so there are natural caves, and they would go in and enlarge those and make those into tombs. So that's where they would bury people and then seal the opening with a rock. So what's happening is you have this demon-possessed man who has nowhere else to live, so he lives in the tombs there, which is pretty gross and disgusting, but very realistic if you've been in that part of the country there. Continuing on, "So there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains. Chains had been pulled apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces. Neither could anyone tame him." And sometimes people who are possessed with demons have been known to possess this greater degree of strength than a normal human being has. It's just a reality that is being described here. Another reality is mentioned next. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones. So another factor about demons or demon-possessed people is they seem to have a very self-destructive tendency about them. The best way I could express it is the demon is trying to kill the body that they inhabit. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshiped him. And worshiped is not the best translation here. It doesn't mean the man is literally worshiping Jesus. It means he bows down to him. That's the word that is used here means. Verse 7, and he cried out with a loud voice and said, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you not torment me." For he said to him, "Come out of the man, unclean spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he answered, saying, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And this gets back to what I mentioned a few minutes ago, first part of this class, that a person can be inhabited by multiple demons. In this case, a legion, he says, "My name is Legion." A Roman legion at that time was about 7,000 people. Does this mean this man is inhabited by 7,000 demons? I don't think so, but it does give an indication he clearly has more than one demon inhabiting him. Perhaps some of you, you used to be a number of years ago, there were several books. I don't necessarily recommend them, just FYI. There was a book called My Name is Sybil that was popular when I was about your age, and it was about an individual who had multiple personalities. And one personality was a woman who lived in the 1700s and was burned as a witch. And another was this personality of a soldier who died in this war centuries before and this kind of thing. And this person could give details of their lives. And because of this, a lot of people believe in reincarnation and so on. Well, no, what it is, it's just a demon who has been alive for thousands of years, millions of years perhaps. Inhabiting these people and these different personalities are actually the different demonic personalities that are being expressed. So I won't say that all cases of multiple personalities are demonic, but that is a very simple explanation for some of the things that we see manifested in that way. Again, won't go into a lot of detail because it's pretty discouraging, but just a quick explanation that adds a little light, sheds a little light on what we see here. So he says, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Also, verse 10, he begged Jesus earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. Now a large herd of swine was feeding there near the mountains. Again, this is on the pagan side, so they're eating pigs. These may well, being a large herd, they may have been pigs that are being raised for sacrifice at the Greco-Roman temples. From down on the Sea of Galilee, if you know where to look, you can actually see some ruins of some of the cities that existed on that pagan city, and you can visit them and see some of the temples and so on there where pigs would have been sacrificed in that day. So all the demons begged Jesus, saying, "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." And at once Jesus gave them permission. Then the unclean spirits went out and entered the swine. There were about 2,000, so this is a huge herd. And the herd ran violently down the steep place into the sea and drowned in the sea. And there is one particular place on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee where the mountain is just as described here, and that's apparently where this takes place. Most of the places, the land slopes down, and then there's a level place going out to sea. But there's one place where, just go straight down the mountain into the sea. And that seems to be where this took place. So here again, we see, as mentioned earlier, this man was cutting himself with rocks, stones, showing this self-destructive tendency. And again, this seems to be what is brought out here, where the demons try to kill the human body they inhabit, or in this case, the animal body. Why do they do that? Best explanation I can think of is they're just miserable, unhappy beings. They know the horrible choice they made in rebelling against God and following Satan instead, and they know what their ultimate fate is, and they just don't want to continue living in that way. And again, I'm not saying that everybody who wants to commit suicide is possessed by a demon or anything like that. No, not at all. But I am just emphasizing that we see here in Scripture there is a self-destructive tendency. There's another case where there's a young boy who or a young man who is possessed by a demon, and he's continually throwing himself into the fires, the cooking fire, to harm and injure himself. So again, there is this self-destructive tendency going on there. Emily, you had a question?
So he had 2,000 different spirits inside of him? Because if all of the pigs were possessed, is that that's possible?
Apparently.
Or is it possible for a demon to possess more than one person at a time?
It is possible for one person to have multiple demons in him. Whether it's 2,000, as it says here, the herd is 2,000. Does that mean every single pig was possessed by a demon? Not necessarily. Herd animals, if you've dealt with herds or flocks or something like that, you know there are a few dominant animals in the herd. And the other animals, if the leaders of the herd or the flock start doing something, the others are going to follow them. So it's possible, there might not have been 2,000 demons in the person, but we just don't know for sure one way or the other. There's obviously a lot because he says, "My name is Legion, for we are many," but it doesn't explicitly say how many there are. Yes, Kayla?
So when a demon-possessed person or thing like the pigs dies, what happens to the demon?
Looks for another place to live. Looks for another place to live. So, yep, they are there. They are real. Mentioned before traveling to the Middle East that area seems to be a hot spot for demonic activity. Africa, if you ever talk to some of our men who spend a lot of time to Africa, who travel there, because of the depravity of the native religions there, the spiritual blindness that exists, Africa is a huge hotspot for demonic activity. I could share with you some of the stories men who've traveled to Africa have shared with me, but I don't want to totally gross you out, but there's witch doctors, there's cannibalism, there's just every horrible, disgusting, demeaning human behavior you can think of there. And it is rife with demonic activity and spiritual blindness. Yes, Danielle?
I guess I've always been a little bit confused by this story because I agree, obviously, that... So what is really the point of sending them then to the pigs who are just about to die, other than to kill pigs, which they're going to eat, which they don't want them to eat, probably.
Yeah.
But, and then I guess Christ is having mercy on them because he didn't send them out of the country?
No, that's a good question, and I honestly don't know, but it's not Jesus who sends them into the pigs. The demons actually asked to go there. So verse 12, so all the demons begged him, saying, "Send us to the swine that we may enter them." So Jesus allows that to happen. Yes, Charlie.
Jesus gave permission to the demons to enter the pigs for Jesus to make a point that this is not food.
Simply. he doesn't do it. Yeah, it's interesting that it's pigs. It's not sheep. It's not goat. It's not cattle or something that is clean and useful. This, again, I think, is why it's probably pigs that are destined to be sacrificed in these pagan temples there. So as far as Christ is concerned, they're utterly worthless. They're not serving any good purpose and will actually be used for a harmful purpose, worshiping. And typically, as you read in the book of Acts and Paul's readings about animals, meat sacrificed to idols, what was typically done is, they would sacrifice an animal at the temple to this god or goddess. And then after that, meat was not a common part of people's diets there. So where you would get cheap meat is from the animals that are sacrificed at the temple. So Paul talks about meat that is sold in the shambles, as it's translated in one version, the King James, I think, or the marketplace or the meat market, as other verses put it. So that was how the common people got meat, as meat that was sacrificed to a pagan god. And that's why it was an issue in the early church there as well. It's all tied in with this pagan practice and worship of pagan gods. And it was utterly reprehensible when it's a pig, an unclean animal, to start with there. So as far as Jesus would have been concerned, yeah, these are good for nothing. So, you know, Jesus is not advocating destroying somebody's private property, but in this case, the demons asked him to enter the swine. And what happens after the pigs are drowned? They go out looking for something else to inhabit. And there's probably plenty of candidates in that Greco-Roman pagan world on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And also, you know, we encounter, just going through the Gospels, not a huge amount, but it is a regular occurrence where Jesus encounters demon-possessed individuals. Yeah, again, that's a part of pagan Greco-Roman culture. We find Paul and Barnabas, I believe it was, who cast demons out of a slave girl who's telling people's fortunes. So it's common in the Greco-Roman world as well. So, Now, unfortunately, in the Greco-Roman world, somebody like this fortune-telling slave girl would have been viewed as a messenger of the gods because she's telling fortunes. So she was making their owners a lot of money. And so it becomes a very, very nasty scene there. So, again, we're not given all the details. It's just what we know there. Yes, yes, Charlie.
Places like Africa and stuff there, there's a lot of demonic possession. When the church goes out there to serve the ministers, do they usually exorcise these demons, I guess you could say, or do like deliverances for these people if they're willing? How does it usually work? Do they do anything about it, or do they?
Yeah, just depends on the circumstances. Obviously, if it's a church member or a church member family, yes, they would try to get rid of that influence, and it happens. It does happen. A lot of times, it's kind of like some of the examples we see in the Gospels where the demon-possessed people will just actively oppose the work that we're trying to do. Sometimes that can get you in trouble because the person who's demon-possessed may be the head man of the village or one of his children or brother or something like that. And if you start messing with that, you can find yourself being opposed by the whole village or the local tribal structure there. So it just has to be handled on a case-by-case basis as to what's happened. But certainly if they're requested to do so, yeah, they will cast them out. So, yeah. Again, this is not a topic I like to get into because the more people think on it, the more they tend to kind of open up their minds to thinking and dwelling on these things. So I don't like to spend a lot of time discussing it. I just find it's better just to go through the facts and stick with that. So here are some very, very clear lessons about this. So continuing on with the story, the 2,000 pigs run all down the mountainside into the Sea of Galilee and drown. Verse 15 of Mark 5, then they came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. Now Luke, we won't turn there, but Luke states earlier that the man was naked and now he's clothed. So maybe they had an extra robe laying in the boat that Jesus gave the man. Maybe Jesus miraculously makes some clothes to give this man. We don't know. We just says now he is wearing clothing and is in his right mind. He's been healed. He's back to normal. Verse 16, and those who saw it told them how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. Then they began to plead with Jesus to depart from their region. This is an unusual reaction, to say the least. Here Jesus has performed this great miracle of healing this man who is possessed with multiple demons, who's been in this horrible state for a long time, who is apparently well known in this area because we read earlier he's shouting and yelling all hours of the day and living in these tombs. And what happens? Jesus casts the demons out, and what do the Gentiles who are living there tell Jesus to do? They plead with him to leave, to get out of there. And this shows again what we've talked about earlier, that darkness hates the light and doesn't want anything to do with it. And here these people are witnessing before their eyes this man who's been healed of this demonic possession, and their reaction is they want Jesus to get out of there and leave him alone. Don't rock the boat. Verse 18, and when he got into the boat, he who had been demon-possessed begged Jesus that he might be with him, go with him, in other words. However, Jesus did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you." And the man departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis, the 10 Greco-Roman cities there, all that Jesus had done for him, and all marveled. So two things to mention here. One is that it says when he, Jesus, verse 18, got into the boat, apparently Jesus is the only one who gets out of the boat. The other 12 don't get out. There's no indication any of them did. So Jesus is the one who gets out of the boat. He's the one who gets back into the boat. Apparently the others are so afraid of this demon-possessed individual, they never even get out of the boat. They pull it up on shore and they stay there and wait for Jesus to come back. Just interesting little sidelight there. And second, this is quite interesting. The man pleads to come with Jesus, but Jesus doesn't allow it. And instead, he tells the man, go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you. And then Jesus leaves the man there, and we never hear from him again. Perhaps the man never even met another Christian. We just don't know. It's just the end of the story. I find it interesting this happens from time to time in the Bible. I might think of the Ethiopian eunuch who has a high position in the government, and Philip baptizes the man as he's on his way back to Ethiopia, and we never hear anything else about the man. Is he the only Christian in that country? Is this the only man who knows Jesus is the Son of God in that Greco-Roman culture there? No doubt others have heard of Jesus, but you know that's the reality. It's that way sometimes today, where we have entire countries where there's only one member or one family who know and understand the truth there. Those people need our prayers. It's just a bad situation to be in. Now we come to another very interesting, let's see, do I have time to cover the first part of this? So let's do that. Mark 5:21. Now when Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side, so he crosses back across the Sea of Galilee, a great multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea. And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed, and she will live." And ruler of the synagogue is a term that comes up several times in the Gospels and Acts, and we would call it today an administrator or a supervisor, maybe, of the synagogue. And this was the person who basically keeps everything going, keeps everything done decently and in order of the synagogue, who keeps it running properly and sees that everything is taken care of. So this is what that term ruler of the synagogue means, the supervisor, the administrator of it, is what we would call it today. So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. But on the way to the synagogue, something happens. Verse 25, now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years. We're not giving details, but there is something clearly wrong with her reproductive system where she has a flow of blood for 12 years. 12 years. And had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. Now, I want to spend some time on this because it's really easy to just read this and not understand the depth of what is going on and the depth of this poor woman's situation. What did this mean in the first century? She has an ongoing flow of blood that has lasted for 12 years. And what does this mean? I didn't write down the scriptures. You can look them up yourself. But under the laws of cleanliness and hygiene that God had given to Israel, if somebody has a flow of blood that could have been an infectious condition, so the person who has a flow of blood is unclean. You might think of what we've talked about with the leper earlier. A leper cannot touch anyone else. They cannot be touched. And that is the situation this woman is in. Not that she's a leper, but she is unclean. She hasn't felt human touch for 12 years. If she was married, her husband cannot touch her. If she has children, her children cannot touch her. Nobody can hug her. Nobody can hold her. Nobody can hold her hand and comfort and encourage her. She is unclean. Since she may well be divorced, maybe her husband has left her because if she can't bear children, as we talked about yesterday, under the interpretation of the laws by some prominent rabbis at that time, if you could not bear children, your husband could divorce her. So if she has this flow of blood for 12 years, she's not bearing children, and her husband can divorce her. Maybe she's divorced. We don't know. Since the first commandment in the Bible, as we talked about earlier, is what? Be fruitful and multiply. And with this flow of blood, she cannot bear children because of whatever the disorder is in her reproductive system there. A woman who could not bear children would be viewed as cursed, as we talked about with John the Baptizer's father and mother, Zechariah and Elizabeth. They're viewed as cursed because they cannot have children. They're not obeying God's command to be fruitful and multiply. So she may be a pariah in her community, being viewed as cursed because she's unable to fulfill God's command to be fruitful and multiply. And if she has children, they cannot touch her because she's unclean. So imagine this is her life for 12 years. Excruciatingly long years. She hasn't felt human touch for 12 years. She hasn't been hugged or kissed or held or touched, not by her husband, friends, family, children, no one. And to add to the indignity, she has spent all of the money she has on doctors trying to find a cure for her condition. And nothing has worked, and she's in a very dark and desperate place, without hope. Does this remind us of the story of the leper that we've talked about earlier, of Matthew, the tax collector, who's viewed as no better than a prostitute, and so evil that his sins can never be forgiven? But Jesus does help the helpless, and he gives hope to the hopeless, as we see here. Verse 27, when she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment, for she said, "If only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well." And immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. So this is astounding. She just touches the hem of his garment and immediately feels that she has been healed. Maybe it's like a jolt of an electric shock or static electricity or something like that. But it's interesting that Jesus feels this as well. Verse 30, and Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" But his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude thronging you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" There's so many people gathered around. How would they know who had touched him? Everybody is gathered around him, touching him. Verse 32, and he looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling and knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." So again, we see a remarkable story of God's power at work. We see all kinds of healings, including this one, where Jesus wasn't even knowledgeable of the healing and didn't even know it until after it had already happened. Again, quite a different scenario there, but again, showing God's mercy and help for somebody who was in a hopeless situation. So we'll break it off there and pick it up again tomorrow. Look forward to seeing all of you then.